Support for WPR comes from Isthmus Partners, an asset management firm providing comprehensive financial planning and tailored investment solutions for long-term growth and capital preservation. More at isthmuspartnersllc.com.
Support for WPR comes from the Dram Corporation, manufacturing professional-grade lawn and garden products since 1941, inventors of the 400 water breaker nozzle and the rain wand, DRAMM.com.
Mary Carr's first memoir, The Liar's Club, kick-started a memoir revolution and earned her a spot on the bestseller lists. This time around, she takes another personal look at her own life and her struggle with alcoholism in the memoir Lit. Here she is with a reading from the book about life with her husband, Warren.
I wouldn't call my pre-Warren drinking out of control because I had control. So long as I didn't leave my apartment, I didn't drink. In Cambridge, though, that person no longer exists. With an invisible eraser, I'm internally rubbing hard at the core of her, and Warren's steady, unwavering gaze is lasering away her external edges. Soon, she'll be missed. I stand at the bar, its tiered bottles like a shiny choir about to burst into song. With only $5 or $6 in tips, how much trouble can I get in? Warren will pick me up soon, and the bar's on the cusp of closing early. At one end, a man in evening clothes with long gray hair swept back sits behind a sherry glass. On the stool next to him, a tipped violin case. Across from him is the despicable waiter, cradling a brandy snifter, his normally ponytailed hairs undone. The waiter says, "Buy you a farewell cognac?"
Carr told Steve Paulson that drinking too much runs in her family.
My mother was a binge alcoholic, I would say, and so she might go a year even without touching a drop, but you never knew when she drank where she'd wind up. You know, she'd be gone for, sometimes she'd be gone for days. She'd just disappear and be holed up drunk somewhere. But yeah, she'd get drunk and marry people. She'd get drunk and shoot at people. One of my favorite stories is, you know, prying off the tile in the kitchen when we were retiling it right after The Liar's Club was published. And the tile guy said, "This looks like a bullet hole," thinking it was a joke, you know. My sister said to my little 80-year-old mother, "Isn't that where you shot at Daddy?" And the tile guy kind of looks up. Mother says, "No, that's where I shot at Larry. Over there is where I shot at your daddy." So that's the way my mother was.
So looking back, why do you think you drank so much?
Because I'm an alcoholic. I mean, I don't think you choose to be an alcoholic. You know, the last thing I wanted to be was an alcoholic. You know, but I think there's in certain people, I think someday they'll identify it genetically. They're getting closer to it.
When you say you're an alcoholic, you mean you were drawn to drink or you couldn't control it? What do you mean you're an alcoholic?
Well, my definition of alcoholism is different than a doctor's or something. I always say, if you have consequences directly stemming from your drinking, things that happen to you that are unacceptable to you, and you continue to drink, you're an alcoholic.
Did you always realize that there were negative consequences to your drinking? I mean, that you were going to pay for this in one way or another?
The thing is, alcohol works, especially for an alcoholic. When you first start drinking, you have more pleasure, I think, than non-alcoholics. My ex-husband, for instance, whom I call Warren in this book, I mean, he would have a couple of beers and he'd get sleepy and go to sleep. He didn't associate it with this, you know, great liberating, exciting event. So I think somehow we metabolize the alcohol. So initially, alcohol really works. But again, I think thinking of it as a disease is helpful because it actually progresses. If you think of it like cancer grows and there's more cancer and it grows and grows, if you think of your drinking progressing, it stops being that much fun, but you're still really compelled to drink. So that's the weird thing. You keep trying to get back to those early days when alcohol really worked. Meanwhile, you have told yourself or you've convinced yourself that this is a solution. This is a solution to your problems, is drinking. It's blows off steam. It lets you relax. You know, nobody really understands what you're going through. You're convivial with your friends when you drink. You know, and you overlook that you, you know, hork your guts out outside your kid's daycare, say, you know, in the family station wagon. You know, I couldn't take my kid to daycare because I was too nauseous in the morning.
Did your husband realize how much you were drinking?
Oh, no, absolutely not. That's how I figured out to throw out the cans. I remember him saying, where's that case of beer I bought? We got some case of beer like at a Sam's Club or something, or I don't know, some cheap liquor store. And he would have literally one beer a night, you know, half a beer, you know, he just wasn't a big drinker. And he said, did you drink all this beer? And I'm like, of course not. You probably drink more than you think. But yeah, I just want to point out that if you had looked at me, you would have seen a thin, well-dressed, slightly agitated or irritated person, you know, who drove a station wagon and lived in a nice suburb of Cambridge and taught at, you know, in the academic ghetto. I didn't look like a drooling, puking, listing, lunging alcoholic. I tried to keep that, although it was leaking out. So, you know, for me, the consequence for me of that drinking was wanting to blow my brains out, was having a black hole inside me that I poured liquor into. And day by day, undermining every dream I ever had. I mean, I remember thinking, I would sit on the back porch and drink whiskey, and I would think, I would actually tell myself, I'm going to get up in the morning and run 5 miles. You know, I hadn't run a step since my baby had been born for like 3 or 4 years, and I'd be completely in the bag, just my head lolling around like one of those bobblehead dogs. And I would tell myself, I'm going to get up and I'm going to run 5 miles, and then I'm going to write, you know, all morning until I go teach my class. It's crazy. It's crazy. So I wasn't pursuing my dream. I also wasn't pursuing my dream of being a mother. I wasn't emotionally present, I think, probably for my kid or my husband or anybody. I think I was just in this bleak mind state. It was just awful.
So when did the drinking start to get worse?
Doesn't that sound bad enough? I mean, isn't that bad enough?
Well, you said there was sort of you
I wanted to suck off the family muffler. You know, I mean, isn't that bad enough? Good God. I wound up in the mental Marriott. It was pretty bad.
The mental Marriott?
Yeah, I mean, when I stopped drinking, I was sick. I had to check into Harvard Infirmary. I was sick like I had the flu. I went through withdrawal. And that's the other thing. You stop drinking and you think, oh, you're going to feel better. The first 2 days you might, but by day 3 or 4, you're going to start detoxing. And, you know, days 3 to 10, you're going to feel like you've been run over by a truck.
So what did it take for you to actually check in there? I mean, what got you to that point?
In some ways, I got healthy enough once I was sober to realize how really deeply clinically depressed I was. And I started to ask for help. I realized I couldn't stay sober by myself. I met a group of women who were also trying to stay sober. And I had a friend who was a Harvard social theorist. I call her Joan the Bone in the book, who was my spiritual advisor. I was complete atheist, you know. But she encouraged me to pray. And, you know, I don't even know how to tell you how ridiculous that was to me. I've been an atheist my whole life. I'd never been baptized. I had no concept of a God. Bad or good. It was just, it seemed like the Easter Bunny to me. So when did it get worse? Well, I almost drove into something that had more molecular density. I'd stayed sober for 90 days and I was better. But I did notice that the people who stayed sober did talk about some spiritual thing. Even the ones who'd say, you know, the group is my higher power or I have a sober self that I pray to. They had some practice, some spiritual practice of some kind. You know, maybe it was just counting breaths in the morning, 1 to 10, to quiet, you know, the mind, the ego. They had some, you know, south of your neck place that they could go into that was sustaining for them. I just had a big black hole in there I wanted to pour Jack Daniels in. So, So in some ways, I had gotten sober. I'd been sober for 90 days, and I had no intention of drinking, and I gave a poetry reading at Harvard, and it was a very, you know, by those standards, a very good success, and went out with some of my students and just drank everything in sight. And the next thing I knew, I was hurtling towards a big piece of concrete on Storrow Drive. And I didn't hit it somehow. It didn't hit me. And that was the last drink I had.
Now, I know a lot of people talk about the being spiritual but not religious, but you're religious, right? I mean, you became a Catholic.
Yeah.
It wasn't just that you realized that you had this great gaping pit in your life, and so therefore you needed something spiritual to sort of pull you out of the drinking. I mean, you found God in whatever way that meant to you, and
baby Jesus, and the Blessed Mother, and all the angels and saints. Oh yeah, I drank the Kool-Aid, but that had nothing to do with anybody else. In fact, my son, we were praying, and I was maybe 4 or 5 years sober when he came to me one Sunday morning and said, I want to go to church. And I said, why? It never occurred to me to go to church. I'd never been in church. He said, I want to see if God's there. And so I did this thing we called God-a-rama, where we went to various churches and mosques and zendos and Southern Baptist and Episcopal and Unitarian and Jewish. And we went to a Jewish midrash. And I brought a paperback. I just brought my son the way I took him to soccer. I brought a mug of coffee and a paperback every Sunday. Anybody who would take us, I'd go along, but it was all for my son. If you had told me I was going to be a Catholic, I would have laughed myself cockeyed, you know, more likely to be a pole dancer at, you know, 40-something, whatever I was. So, yeah, and I have found a comfort in the church. A lot of things I'm sure I'm not the Pope's favorite Catholic. A lot of things with the church I'm not crazy about. But, you know, it's sort of like when you have a president you don't like or there's a war you don't like. You don't stop calling yourself an American. You know, you still vote. So even though there are things about the church hierarchy and doctrine that I don't like, I love the simple faith of the people. And I love the tradition of Catholics working with the poor, which is, of course, you know, every spiritual tradition has that. You know, the Muslims and the Buddhists, and they all have a thing about being nice to each other.
You've described this book as really a journey into awe, and you've just been talking about that. Has that affected your writing, too? I mean, other than, you know, actually writing about your spiritual life, but has it changed the way you write?
Yeah, I actually pray about what to write. I ask the Holy Spirit to guide me every day to write kind of the next true thing. It's something Hemingway said, not Jesus. You know, he said, just write the next true sentence. And I sort of ask before I write to be of service and to write, you know, the next true thing, whatever is the true thing that I have to write.
Mary Carr is a prize-winning memoirist and author of The Liars Club. Steve Paulson spoke to her about her latest book called Lit.